This is the BBC.
In the run-up to today's programme, I began searching for clips of our subject. There are heaps on the internet, but nothing that we can broadcast beyond reviews for a film made of his life. And even if we could, it would only be audio, and this man's genius is so much in what the Americans call the optics. There was one video, though, on YouTube that I really liked. Andy Kaufman, or Kaufman. There's debate about how to pronounce his name. October the 15th, 1980. A man with unruly hair shakes the chat show host's hand and sits down. He looks vaguely distracted and doesn't speak. Not once. For the opening 2 minutes or so, all he does is roll his eyes and try to wipe his top lip. Listed below that YouTube clip, there's a stream of admiring messages. Like this. Kaufman was both fiction and non-fiction, wrote one. Followed by, you never saw this on television at the time. He's playing the anti-talk show host. Followed by, I can't wait for Trump to win the presidential election. Then halfway through his victory speech, the president takes off the rubber mask and reveals himself as Andy Kaufman. It's the only logical explanation for his success. But who is Andy Kaufman? Time to introduce my guest, who's going to fill us in on this extraordinary man. Ian Lee is a broadcaster who's left many a fine programme to pursue other avenues, as Kaufman did. He's been the host of a Channel 4 breakfast show, as well as host of their late-night 11 o'clock show, fronted documentaries, worked for radio programmes all over Britain, fired as often as he's been hired, and hired as often as he's been fired. Well. He's a pro who recognises Kaufman's roller coaster genius. So, Ian, tell us about your choice.
Andy Kaufman, I absolutely love. Like a lot of people, I was vaguely aware of him growing up because of his role in Taxi, the American sitcom that was big in the late 70s. But the moment that I really got that he was a genius was, like a lot of people, was the Jim Carrey film, Man on the Moon, Man in the Moon. And I watched that being neither a fan of Kaufman or Carey and was just blown away by the audacity of Andy. He was a performer, and I wouldn't call him a comedian. He didn't do straight stand-up. I would say he was more of a performance artist. You know, if you want to get very heavy, you can say he's a Dadaist. But he was a performance artist who took great pleasure in making the audience laugh, but also, and this is what I find really interesting, making the audience really uncomfortable. That clip you mentioned of him on the David Letterman show, it came at a really weird period in his life. Taxi had been cancelled. He'd started a Broadway show with Debbie Harry that lasted two performances. He'd been in a film that had tanked miserably. So in some ways, he was on a downward trend. And that performance is delicious because, as you say, he says nothing for the first couple of minutes. And then Letterman says, Andy, I believe you want to go and do your little piece. And the audience are expecting a 5 minute comedy monologue. And instead, he sits on a stool, talks about his marriage breaking down, his career failing, and if anybody's got any money, could they please spare some? And the audience start chucking coins at him and giggling really uncomfortably. Some get the joke, most of them don't. And it's that awkwardness that he would bring into an audience that I find fascinating.
How much of this is real, as it were, and how much is his act? Do you think, for instance, that David Letterman expected this to happen?
I was showing some clips of Kaufman to a friend of mine, and she was going, well, is this real? Is this real? And at the end, I had to say, look, if you're seeing him on camera, it's probably not real. You never knew what you were going to get with him.
I imagine that lots of our listeners won't have heard of the person whose name is, I now know, pronounced Kaufman,
well,
and not Kaufman.
I think both are correct. I think the Americans go for the Kaufman and I go for the Kaufman. Either or.
Where will anyone who does remember him have seen him? Would it be Taxi?
Taxi was the big show for him. It was a sitcom in the late 70s, early 80s. It had Danny DeVito and a few others. And in that sitcom, Andy played a character called Latka Gravas.
Yeah, foreign man.
Foreign man, which was his first kind of stand-up routine, was this foreign man. Thank you very much, you know. And he really enjoyed the financial security and the fame that Taxi brought him. But he also hated it. He thought sitcoms were a sellout. He had himself written out of episodes, whereas everyone was trying to get more episodes. And he tried to jeopardise taxi. He had this this very dark alter ego called Tony Clifton. And everybody knew that Tony Clifton was this kind of lounge singer. Yeah, what are you looking at? You know, that kind of thing. And everyone knew it was Andy Kaufman. But he had it written into his contract that there would be two episodes of Taxi where Andy wasn't in it, but Clifton was in it. And the whole cast kind of went along with it, but thought it was an indulgence. On the day of the script read-through, he turned up 4 hours late. He turned up drunk. He turned up with two hookers on each arm. And he began to just rip the script to shreds. All of the other cast went nuts and they were walking off set and they threatened to leave the sitcom. And Andy loved it. Andy loved the fact that he was creating theatre that would only be seen by 15, 20 people. It would never get broadcast. It would never get out into the bigger world. But he just loved creating scenes where people got angry or flustered.
Now, to help persuade our radio audience that this too is not a spoof programme, we're going to be assisted by our expert, Ollie Double.
Can I start by picking up on your pronunciation there? Because yeah. Kaufman, right. Kaufman is, I mean, it's a German name by origin, yeah. So you'd think Kaufman. A lot of people in America pronounce it Kaufman. There's a David Letterman appearance where Letterman pronounces it both ways.
Yes, yeah.
Right? And apparently Kaufman, would delight in saying people's names incorrectly. And what I think is his birth name was Andy Kaufman, but he preferred Andy Kaufman as a professional name.
Wonderful.
So what is brilliant about him is we don't even know how his name's pronounced. Right?
Can you promise our listeners that this man really existed?
he definitely really existed and may still.
Ollie is, I should say, Dr. Oliver Double from the University of Kent School of Arts and a past expert on this programme's edition about Lenny Bruce. Let's start with Andy's early years, Ollie. Where was he born? What were his parents like?
So his dad was a businessman, a costume jewellery business. His mum was, a sort of homemaker. She had been, I think, a model earlier in her life. And they were just regular folks. There's a book that a journalist wrote or published after he died, which was based on a series of encounters she had with him in around 78, 79. And she describes them as just looking like very typical suburban people. He grew up in Great Neck, Long Island, a sort of typical sort of suburban place, very sort of square and regular. And he was anything but that. He was a child who stuck out for being different.
Describe how?
Well, he used to, for example, lock himself in his room and pretend to be presenting a TV show to the wall, imagining that people were seeing him for 4 hours at a time.
And it wasn't a kid playing. It was a completely thought out show with theme tunes, characters, repeating memes. It was really detailed.
Yeah, a different genre as well. Monster movies, silent movies, yeah. And he would eventually get a schedule so there would be half-hour programmes and then it would change. And later he would do that at school and kids would sometimes happen across him and just watch, amazed at this crazy person. And he was sent for sort of for psychiatric help at various times and through the school and through his parents.
But also, I mean, it was that typical thing. He was a very shy kid, and so to hide the shyness, he would do these performances. And at the age of eight, he was making money from doing magic at kids' birthday parties.
I think what happened was he was invited to go and do a kid's party and to show films on an old projector. He had to show bits of things like Mighty Mouse, I suppose, and things like the ladies doing the stick dance with the horses that he used later in his Carnegie Hall show. And when he got a little bit older into his early teens, what happened was he, unbeknownst to his parents, put a small ad in the local sort of free newspaper and started doing it for money. Mm. And you can find photos of him, you know, performing as a sort of adolescent to little children in party hats, making them sing The Cow Goes Moo.
The majority of his act was a very similar act to what he was doing for eight-year-olds, but just taking that and doing it in the comedy store and doing it for you know, the hip 70s audiences, doing a kid's act in front of adult audiences. And you mentioned the song, The Cow Goes Moo. There's footage of him doing it with these, you know, these 20-somethings, and it's him at the piano going, right, everybody, we're going to sing. When I say OK, you say OK, OK, and they all join in. The cow goes moo, and people would lap this up. Again, people would think he was a whack job and would hate it and people would walk out. But people would lap it up.
What did he look like? Our listeners will be wondering. What the appearance of this man?
He was an amazing-looking guy, actually. He had enormous eyes, which were incredibly expressive. And I think that they were one of his most important performance tools.
Yeah.
You know, that he does a thing where he, when he's being foreign man, he does a thing where he looks to the side nervously a lot. And that's a good way of really making the audience feel uncomfortable, because the whole thing with the foreign man character was that he was pretending to be going down really, really badly. He was a terrible comic act. And the audience would be laughing. And at a certain point, he goes, I don't know whether you laugh at me or with me. And I think that's a genius yeah, line, yeah. Incidentally, and it really shows he knows what he was doing. So, yes, his hair was kind of curly and like a lot of it, like a
quite
mad
sweet
sort of cloud.
Looking as a youth, wasn't
very
it?
Very sweet yes. looking as a
and
youth.
And he had a uniform. He had his check jacket. He had his shirt with quite often a cravat or a polo neck jumper
yeah.
and smart slacks. And sometimes he wore his I Love Grandma sweatshirt, which
yes.
is...
Tell me about his beatnik phase. Was that genuine? He went through a bit of a kind of long-haired lover phase, didn't he?
Yeah, he went through a phase where he got into booze. He found a friend group, which was quite a difficult thing for him to do, and they sort of hung out and they smoked joints and things like this. And they got in trouble with the local police and that kind of thing.
He got beaten up.
Yeah, he got beaten up. But they used to pretend to beat each other up as well as theatre for other people, unknowing theatre. And also, another aspect of his beatnik phase was that he got into poetry and he got to Jack Kerouac and On the Road. And he found a way of getting from Great Neck into Greenwich Village and playing these legendary coffee houses. And as a teenage kid, like too late for the actual beatniks, he went and read his own poetry. I find that amazing. And he claimed, this is probably untrue because he self-mythologised a lot, but he claimed that an uncle or somebody had given him a beatnik dressing up kit. If that's true, it's delicious.
But he did get in a bit of trouble with drugs and alcohol. He experimented with LSD. He did drink a lot. And the thing that he cites as saving him from that was he discovered transcendental meditation, of course, which the Beatles did. And you know, and when his career was heading down, just before he got diagnosed with cancer, he said, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Switzerland. I'm going to meditate for 2 weeks and that'll be cool. And he phoned up to book his place. And the transcendental meditation people said, no, we don't want you. Your lifestyle, your act is incompatible with us. And he took that as the greatest rejection. He was heartbroken by that and absolutely devastated that the one solid, safe, sane place he could go to had basically told him to get lost.
We ought to take him through college, as it were.
Yeah.
He was enrolled in, was it Boston? And he avoided the draft on account of medical.
Medical. Yeah.
they said he was insane.
Yeah, which, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
He went to this little institutional school, I think it was Graham Junior College, and they did sort of media. And suddenly, having not done that well in school, I suspect not because he was unintelligent, but because he didn't care.
Yeah.
Suddenly he started to become a student that actually was achieving.
Yeah.
But also he found people who were on his wavelength, who encouraged him to try doing this stuff. And so he did Uncle Andy's Fun House, right, which was sort of like a children's program for adults, you know, sort of riddled with irony. And then he did, you know, years later, he did a pilot for ABC of that, I think in 1980, and they rejected it. And you can find the footage on air. It's pretty funny and weird. It makes you feel that Kaufman was perhaps slightly before his time.
You're listening to The Great Life of Andy Kaufman, proposed by Ian Lee and supported by Ollie Double. I read out some comments earlier from admirers. This one is more ambiguous. The distance between genius, idiot and whack job is surprisingly short. It strikes me that you're going to have to work pretty hard to persuade some listeners that this really is a great life rather than a kind of huge lifelong hoax of some kind. I mean, he even talked of faking his own death.
Well, he was... Everything with him was a prank. How far could he push things?
Yeah.
And you're right, he did. Just before he got ill, he died of cancer in, I think, 84 at the age of 35. And just before he got ill, taxi had been cancelled, he was losing a lot of money. And he said, how can we turn this around? And he had a writing partner, Bob Zmuda. And he said, right, I know what we're going to do. I'm going to fake my own death. And Bob Zmuda went, Andy, you can't do that. He said, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to fake my own death. It will be the greatest gag ever. And Bob said, I'm not getting involved in this. By coincidence, about 4 or 5 months later, he got diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer. And so a lot of the people around him were thinking, oh, Andy, this gag really is not, this is not a funny thing that you're doing. And it wasn't. It was, you know, it was the boy who cried wolf. You know, at his funeral, it was an open casket and people were still waiting for Andy to kind of spring out and go, ta-da, I've had you. And of course he didn't. So, but going back to the genius or a whack job, I agree. I think it is a very fine line between genius and whack job. But the reason I think he's a genius, my interpretation of a genius is someone who can look at the world in a completely unique way and convey what they are seeing in a way that no one else could. And Andy, for me, does that. If you go back to his very, very first performance, it's him doing the very old vaudeville music hall act of miming to a record. And he would walk on in this kind of checked jacket and shirt and smart slacks, put on a record player, put on a 7-inch record of the Mighty Mouse, the cartoon theme tune. He would only mime to the lines that Mighty Mouse, here I come to save the day. He wouldn't mime to the rest of it. So for 2.5 minutes, most of the time he's just stood there looking at the audience. He mimes, I think it's 3 or 4 lines. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Childlike, naive, innocent, wonderful.
Let's not forget, he was very successful. So he did the famous Carnegie Hall concert. Now, that's a 2,800-seat venue. And not long before that, he did 2 nights at the Huntington Hartford, I think it was called, a theatre in LA. And he sold out. I think that was about 1,000 seats.
And the joy of those performances, sorry to interrupt, Ollie, again, just showing this childlike quality. At the end of both those performances in Carnegie Hall, 2,800 people, he did the show and the show finished. Everyone went, oh, that's brilliant, that's fantastic. He said, well, no, the show's not finished. If you go outside, I've got a fleet of school buses and we're going to go and buy you milk and cookies. And they went, oh, Andy, that's so sweet. And the audience traipsed outside.
And there were buses.
There were 25 school buses. And they all got on and he took them 5 blocks downtown and he bought them all milk and cookies.
He was and had to be pretty famous to get that Carnegie Hall booking. TV made him famous. Who got him into TV? Did he have an agent?
Well, he had some of the best agents. George Shapiro, who was one of the biggest Hollywood agents. I mean, he kind of broke in New York, playing places like the Comedy Store and the Improv. Was that in New York, I think?
It was the Improv and Catch a Rising Star.
And that kind of got him his name. But he said, I'm going to go to Hollywood. Hollywood is where it's at. I mean, his plan was to make movies. But he went to Hollywood and George Shapiro and his team kind of took him on, didn't they?
Yes, that's right.
A big management machine behind
him. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the thing is that goes back to the point about, you know, don't dismiss him as being a guy who's talentless. He was an extraordinary performer and he couldn't have got somebody like Shapiro representing him. And he couldn't have got cast in a big sitcom like that if he wasn't brilliant.
And lots of early TV appearances. I mean, he appeared on some big shows. He appeared on the Dick Van Dyke sketch show as a regular. I think he appeared as the foreign man on there. He appeared on a show with Cher. And a lot of the hip people in the 70s...
objected.
Well, a lot of them objected, but a lot of them got it. Johnny Cash got it.
It's also worth saying that he was obsessed with Elvis from quite a young age, and part of his act was to impersonate Elvis kind of brilliantly. But in fact, the kind of culmination of the foreign man bit was having done a bunch of terrible imitations. He goes, now I do the Elvis, and he turns around and he does a bit of changing, and he turns around and he's this amazing Elvis impersonator.
He became Elvis. Yeah, it became a brilliant impression.
Yeah, it is. And apparently, he went to, after Elvis died, he and Zmuda went to visit Graceland and they went, oh, you're a big star. We'll come and show you some private bits that the regular tourists don't see. And they saw a bunch of Elvis's videotapes and apparently there was one labelled Andy Kaufman. Yeah. And he'd apparently Elvis had been a big fan.
Tell us a bit, Ollie, about his personal life.
Well, he was a very unconventional man, very sort of sexually voracious.
Women? Men?
Certainly a lot of women and possibly men too. There's a book that was published a few years ago by Bob Smooder, his second book on Kaufman, and he claims that Andy came out to him as gay at the end of it. But I can't believe he was purely gay given the number of women that he had sort of knowledge of, as it were, through his life.
Did he ever marry?
He never married, but he was in a more committed relationship at the end of his life. Somebody called Lynn Margulies, who I think he met on the set of a film called My Breakfast with Blassie, which is a weird film that he made towards the end of his life. It was sort of satire on My Dinner with Andre, but it was him having breakfast with a wrestler.
He was the intergender wrestling world champion. I don't really know how it started, but he would quite often use the wrestling to pick up women. And when he had a woman pinned down on the mat, whether it was on Saturday Night Live or in one of his concerts, he would kind of whisper, "Can you believe all these people are watching us wrestle? Why don't you come backstage after the show?" And he had a very high hit rate with women that would come and meet him after the show, yes.
But apart from sexual conquest, did he have a private life? Did he have a home? Did he entertain? Was he entertained? What was he like?
Well, he had a modest home, apparently, and he had a social circle. But, I mean, one of his close friends, I think it was Lynn, she was asked about who is the real Andy Kaufman, and she said there is no real Andy Kaufman. He used to do put-ons and pranks through much of his life. Playing with what reality was something that he did relentlessly.
I think there are similarities with him and Peter Sellers. I mean, yes. Peter Sellers he bought lots of material things. I think Kaufman didn't. He was very minimalist. But in that essence that no one knows Peter Sellers. No one knows what Peter Sellers... Mm. No one even knows what Peter Sellers' real voice is like, because he would always kind of slightly mimic the person that was interviewing him. You never got the real Sellers. And I think that there is a similarity with Andy in that there are no interviews where you see the real Andy. There are some where you see a little bit more than others, but generally you don't see the real Andy. And there is very little known about his private life, apart from his sexual conquests, apart from his meditation, apart from his obsession with Elvis. But there are very few, apart from Bob Zemuda, there are very few friends that have come out and said, "Well, I used to go out for dinner with Andy," or me and Andy would go and watch a movie. There's none of that about him.
Yeah, there was a thing that I think it was in the Zemuda book where Lynn wrote bits of it. Lynn Margulies wrote bits of it as well. And they were saying that he used his real voice with them, but they rarely heard it otherwise, you know, that it was almost like whenever he was out in the world, he was being this strange, crazy...
It was a chance for a performance.
Yes, quite.
You mentioned, both of you, Tony Clifton. Tell us a bit more about Tony Clifton, who he was and what happened when he came on the set of Taxi.
Go on, Ollie, you go.
OK, so Tony Clifton was supposed to be a sort of Vegas lounge singer. Yeah. So he wore like a sort of pinkish jacket. He was rotund. As the character developed, they had prosthetic pieces made for the face. He smoked cigars. He drank. And he was just obnoxious. He would talk to people in the audience. He would pour water on people in the audience. Although when he did that, it was often like Zemuda. I think that was he was a plant in the audience, and he kind of had water flow.
And he was an adequate lounge singer. He'd come out singing Volare adequately, but then he would be peppering the audience. What are you looking at me for? And would abuse the audience.
Well, one of the things was that he would insist that the audience stopped smoking before he came out because of his voice. Yeah. And then he'd walk out smoking. So instantly he's got their back up.
I pick up from this that his mate Zemuda used sometimes to be Tony Clifton. It didn't have to be him.
Kaufman would go out as Clifton.
Yeah.
And for a while people didn't know it was him. And so he would go and do gigs as Tony Clifton and would abuse people, then jump in the car and drive off. Over a period of time, people got wise to the fact that it was Andy Kaufman. So people would book Tony Clifton, but there would be a wink and a nudge that we know we're getting Taxi star Andy Kaufman, but we won't mention Andy Kaufman. We'll just say Tony Clifton. And Kaufman got really upset with this, going, the gag has kind of eaten itself. They know it's me. How can we take this to the next stage? And the next stage was getting his friend Bob Zemuda to learn how to be Clifton. He became Tony Clifton, and he wore the makeup. He learnt the mannerisms. He learnt the shtick. I've read somewhere that every Tony Clifton appearance on David Letterman is Bob Zemuda. I don't know how true that is or not.
Certainly some of them are supposed to be Zemuda, and apparently Letterman went, "Oh, Andy, you really don't look like yourself today. I don't think it's you." And it wasn't.
And then the great gag was, you know, you'd have Tony Clifton on stage and everyone's thinking, "Oh, this is Andy Kaufman. It's brilliant." And Clifton would go, "I want to bring out this guy. He's a bit of a loser and he's kind of been trading on my name. And it's Andy Kaufman." And Kaufman would walk out. And it's the equivalent of Borat being on stage and him introducing Sacha Baron Cohen. Yeah. You know, everyone was like, "How is this possible?"
Now, tell me about the Taxi incident. Yes. Tell us about Tony Clifton.
Well, this was the contempt that Andy had for Taxi. And he had it written to his contract that there would be two episodes that his friend Tony Clifton would be the guest star. Mm. And because they wanted to please Kaufman, they went, OK, now we can work that. And they wrote some scripts where Clifton came on and was
with
Danny
DeVito.
Separate
contracts
as well. Separate contracts. It was all separate. And Tony Clifton...
A contract for the imagined person.
Yeah. And Clifton was going to be, I think, Danny DeVito's brother or brother-in-law or something in the story. They get on set and straight away he looks at the script and goes, nah, this is rubbish. I got some ideas. What I want to do. And tore the script apart. And everyone went nuts. Apart from Danny DeVito, I cannot stress enough, Danny DeVito, you see any interview with him, he only speaks in the fondest terms. He goes, I thought Kaufman was a genius. I loved him. All the others, Tony Danza, Mary Lou Henner, Judd Hirsch, even now you see interviews with them and they are very, very reluctant to sing his praises. And Kaufman, Clifton, excuse me, eventually got kicked off the set, didn't he?
We've sounded so far like a three-man fan club for Andy Kaufman, but I'm going to ask you in a rather tough question.
Please do, Matthew.
Was he a bit of a one-act pony? Didn't audiences, in the end, just get a bit fed up with it?
I think there's an element of that, Matthew. Yeah, definitely. And audiences did turn against him towards the end. There was a famous episode of Saturday Night Live where Andy Kaufman said, right, what we're going to do is we're going to have a vote as to whether people want me to stay on Saturday Night Live or whether they want me to go. And quite overwhelmingly, people phoned to get rid of him. And he was heartbroken. He took that rejection. And I do think that there was a tipping point where a significant, you might disagree, Ollie, I don't know, but that a significant number of the TV audience, the people sat at home eating their dinner in front of the TV, grew sick of him and grew bored of his pranks.
And I think there's something else as well, which is even earlier than that. There was quite an early, very perceptive piece published in an American newspaper about him. And they were saying, the problem is, it's very difficult for him to play with the audience's perception because he has a critical mass of people who are hip to what he's doing. And I think that is the difficult thing. How do you, if you've challenged and challenged and challenged an audience, how do you then take the next step? And I think, you know, I don't believe he's alive, right? But of all the people who are supposedly fake their own death, he's the most plausible.
Yes.
Because he talked about it, allegedly, according to some sources, in really great detail about things like finding a corpse body double to replace him, and talked about how he could lose weight to look like he had cancer, all this kind of thing. So there's part of me, a tiny part, a part of 1% of me that kind of thinks he's out there somewhere working in a diner.
Go back to those comments you read from YouTube at the start of the show, and that is a delicious comment. I expect Donald Trump to halfway through his term to pull his mask off, and it's Andy Kaufman. And that kind of shows just how much he's seeped into American consciousness, barely known over here. And I think towards the end of his life, he probably was having a bit of a fallow idea period. I think he was running out of ideas. I believe he would have got those ideas back again. I think he would have disappeared for a while, not faked his own death, but would have disappeared for a while and would have come back with something new and astounding.
I should mention that he died of lung cancer, aged 35. My thanks to Ian Lee for nominating Kaufman and to Ollie Double for filling in some of the extraordinary details of the life of Andy Kaufman. I loved that programme. I loved it. It had just a kind of hint of the anarchy of Kaufman himself, although, fortunately, neither of you have started wrestling me yet.